The Royal Bank of Scotland is Britain's second largest bank. About 60 days ago, there was a news report that came out about this bank, and it was of interest maybe to primarily the people who were there, but I caught the story as well. The bank demanded that its employees have an account with them. All 14,000 employees were told to have an account with the Royal Bank. And if they did not do that, they were going to face discipline. Well, maybe the story made news because it didn't sit real well, saying you either bank here or you're going to face some kind of punishment. And I guess that's still being resolved now. Well, no matter how one might feel about the bank's decision as I read that story and as you think about that information, it reminds us of something. That is, actions have consequences. Now, that's not always the case, but that is frequently the case. In the instance of the big bank, the consequence was you're going to face discipline. There's going to be some kind of punishment. There will be a negative job consequence if you do not have an account with our bank. Certainly, as we look at life, we find other things that are sometimes closely associated with consequences. We've spent some time looking at Satan and his origin. We've shown that the passages commonly used to describe the devil's beginnings, and therefore, are incorrect. We used last week a lot of deductive reasoning, and as far as the Bible goes, Old and New Testament passages, to show that the best evidence that we have is that Satan is a fallen angel. He rebelled, and because of that, because of his sin, there were some consequences. Stated another way, Satan sinned, and God simply didn't wave his hand and say, well, you shouldn't have done that. But Satan did sin. And from that sin, or because of that sin, God said there were going to be consequences. Satan was punished. There are at least two passages that deal with this. One is Jude 6. I'm going to begin reading there. And then flipping back a few pages to 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, Peter deals with the same subject, only he uses slightly different wording. And again, Jude 6, the thrust of that verse is that Satan sinned and he was punished by heaven. And angels that kept not their own principality, but left their proper habitation, he hath kept in everlasting bonds unto darkness, unto the judgment of the great day. Satan and his helpers lost their heavenly position once they engaged in what was wrong. Jude, as you look at his passage, he speaks of everlasting bonds, darkness, and punishment in eternity. Peter, of course, in that second letter, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, deals with basically this same thing. He says that God did not spare the angels when they sinned. He also makes note of the fact that they were cast down and they were committed to a very interesting place. If you flip back to that second letter, 2 Peter 2, 4, let's see how he words the thought. For if God spared not the angels when they sinned, that's a way of affirming that he did do that, but cast them down to hell and committed them to pits of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. And then he continues on with some illustrations. Peter affirms that angels sinned, and when they engaged in that sin, God did not spare them. A bank has said to its employees, if you do not bank here, you will pay a price. Angels failed to abide by the heavenly arrangement, whatever that was. And because of that refusal, God cast them down. Angels were literally evicted from the heavenly realm. Peter goes on to say that they have been committed to pits of darkness, and they are reserved unto judgment. But perhaps out of all the things that Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 2 are these words. They were cast down to hell. Now here's a place, especially if you use the King James or the American Standard Translation, where you need to use some care. Because in both of those translations, the word hell does not always mean hell in the sense that we normally use it. When we speak of hell, we mean, of course, eternal punishment, eternal forever separation from God in a place that is very, very unfavorable. But that's not what Peter has in mind in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. If you have a good study Bible, one that either has footnotes or maybe there are notes in the margin, you should see a little number or an asterisk. And that will direct you to a note that says the word that's translated hell is really Tartarus. Tartarus, if you remember way back when to some of the studies that maybe you had in high school or college, that was a word that was often used in mythology. It was used by the Greeks and the Romans. As far as their beliefs, it was part of pagan thought. And according to that line of thought, it was where the wicked people went. When someone offended the gods, and I'm using a small g there, then they were sent to Tartarus. Supposedly, a person in Tartarus was put into a chair, and they could not move, and they suffered that plight, at least for a period of time. Well, even though this word was used in pagan thought, Peter, of course, did not have in mind pagan teaching. Tartarus is explained by the information that we already read, that passage back there in Jude 6. Tartarus is a place of darkness. where God keeps evil spirits until the judgment day. It is not a pleasant place. Peter says in the second chapter that Tartarus is a place of darkness. That's an interesting word. Vine, in his expository dictionary of New Testament words, defines it as thick darkness. And then he adds this, darkness that may be felt. Have you ever had a time, maybe you're on vacation or maybe the circumstances were somewhat different than that, but you were in a position where you went down deep into the earth? It may have been a cave, it may have been a cavern, and there may have been a guide that was lighting the way, or maybe there were lights, and then after you were down so far, the guide turned off the flashlight or threw the switch, and all of the lights were turned off. I've had that experience once or twice in my life. We were down, I'm thinking of one time in particular, down in the earth deep enough where when the lights that were available were turned off, when that light source was terminated, it was impossible to see anything. You could wave your hands in front of your face and you could look every possible way, and there was literally no light there whatsoever. And that's really what Peter is trying to describe here. This is the image of angels in the place where they have been cast. Now I really wish, here's a passage in the Bible that as I look at it, I really wish Peter would have said it at least a little more. Maybe just use one more verse to say some things about Tartarus, but he didn't do that. I also, as I look at this particular place, find that Tartarus is mentioned only here in the Bible. There is not another reference to it as far as a passage that uses this word. If there is, therefore, any additional reference or any more information about Tartarus in the Scriptures, we're going to have to find it somewhere besides 2 Peter chapter 2. And we're going to have to study it from a standpoint other than the word Tartarus, because as we said, as we noted, the word is only used here in the New Testament. Well, that has been done by a number of people, and the only thing that lines up with Tartarus as we really look at all the 66 books of the Bible is part of the place that we call Hades. Back in Luke chapter 16, Jesus provided some information about two men. He also, depending on the translation that you have, some translations would use the word hell, and again, that is a passage which uses that word in a way that we now no longer understand it. Back in 1611, people understood the word hell to sometimes mean Hades, and sometimes it meant hell in the sense of that eternal place of punishment. We've perhaps lost some of that information. That's no longer clear to some people, but that's why that word is used in that particular way. But in Luke 16, Jesus speaks of two men. He said there was a rich man and there was a poor man. The rich man was wealthy. The Bible goes on to say he was very, very wealthy, but all his wealth was related to the here and now, this world. He was not right as far as his relationship with God. So spiritually, he was very poor. A second man in the text is known as Lazarus. He was materially poor, but he was spiritually rich. Jesus said the day came when both of these men died. They lost their earthly existence. He went on to say that both of these men went to the same place. He identifies this place in Luke 16, verse 23, as Hades. Now, as you look at that word that's translated Hades, and that is the best translation of the word that we have, it is a word that means the realm of the dead. It is a word that means the place of departed spirits. In other words, when a person dies, whether that is a young person, whether that's an old person, whether the person is a Christian or not a Christian, whether they have died under the Christian dispensation, or whether they were back there with the time of Adam and Eve and Moses, during those periods, it is the place where all the deceased go. In Luke 16, we find that there are two sections or two divisions in the Hadean realm. On one side of Hades, and sometimes we might illustrate it well for people with a circle. If you can imagine a circle and then drawing a line down the middle, or a box that's separated into two different sections. On one side of Hades, on one side of our box, we have a section for the unsaved. In Luke 16, verse 23, the Bible says Lazarus and the rich men were in the same area. That is, they were both part of the box, or they were both part of the circle. But there was a line between them. They were in two different environments. There are two different sections to this particular place. The line that we're describing is referred to in Luke 16, verse 26. Jesus says there was a great gulf between these two sections. And the people on this side could not get to the other side, and the people on this side could not get over to the other. Now many believe, and I am of this persuasion, that the place called Tartarus in 2 Peter chapter 2 is also related to Hades in Luke chapter 16. I know of no reason to reject the idea that Tartarus is part of the bad side of Hades. In fact, I think there are some things that indicate that. Among the evidence that we can adduce for that idea is this. In the book of Revelation, chapter 20 and verse 14, John says Hades is one day going to be destroyed. That place that we read about in Luke chapter 16, it is a temporary holding place for people when they die. Peter said that angels are held in chains, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, for how long? Eternity? No. He said, till the coming judgment. So I learned from 2 Peter chapter 2 that Tartarus is a temporary holding place. When I look at Hades, Luke 16 and Revelation chapter 20, I find that Hades is also a temporary holding place. Now maybe that's just a coincidence, but we know for sure, we know beyond any doubt that both serve this same function. They're both temporary holding places. Peter tells me that Tartarus is a place of punishment. It's a place where they're chained. It's a place where there is darkness. It is not a favorable environment. What do I find about Hades in Luke 16? I find that there are two different sections, two different components to that place, and in one of those sections, it is a very, very unfavorable environment. A man described the punishment in that place as being in anguish. He said, I'm in anguish in this flame. So one side of the Hadean realm lines up very, very well with the Tartarus. Others have gone a step further, and they have said if there are degrees of punishment and reward, Tartarus may describe a section of Hades which is the very worst of that bad side. It may be the lowest possible level, and that is something to consider as well. Now, Peter's statement in 2 Peter 2, verse 4 does leave me with some questions. If the angels are chained, and that's what Peter affirms, does that then mean that these creatures can have no interaction with men? I don't know about you, but when I think of someone being chained, I think of them being restricted to the point where they can't really get at me. In other words, if there is a police officer and he handcuffs someone, that pretty much limits that individual and there's not a whole lot that he can do. Well, as I think about that, I then have to ask the question, if that's what Peter is trying to describe, how then can we deal with things like demon possession in the first century? Well, again, we have to take the information that we have and imply and infer some things. Take what the information implies and use some deductive reasoning. We need to piece the information together. Now, we know two things for sure. We know, first of all, that the angels have been chained. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. That's a fact, and it's just too clear to miss. Secondly, we know that Satan and his demons were active in the first century. We can't dispute that fact either. We believe that because the Bible emphasizes that. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as well as the book of Acts. Given those two facts, we have a limited number of choices as far as explaining how they go together. One option is this. Some have suggested that as we look at the angels that are in Tartarus, of the evil angels that sinned, there is only a section or there's only a segment. Part of those angels have been chained, but there are other angels that have not been chained. Stated another way, the idea is that the really bad evil spirits, that almost sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? But the really bad evil spirits, they've been chained up. And these other evil spirits that were not quite so wicked, they have not been chained. Well, again, that is an explanation, but that to me does not seem to be the most attractive possibility. Jesus often illustrated spiritual truths with things of this earth. That is, he took ordinary things from life and he was able to make spiritual applications. And as we try to sort through some things in the Bible, sometimes, since Jesus used that methodology, that's also helpful to us. And I think I'm going to employ that type of interpretation here. In life, we can watch TV or we can look at our own community and we can see situations where people are incarcerated. Maybe a jail situation, it may be a person that has been put into prison. But during these cases where we see confinement, we also see situations or circumstances where there are periods where some of those restrictions are lifted. For example, we have a man who's a prisoner. Let's say that he's a prisoner in a state facility. But even though he's a prisoner, even though he's confined, restricted, are there not times when a prisoner is allowed to attend a funeral? That happens. Or we find that there are sometimes the deathbed visits that prisoners are allowed to make. Here's a man who's in a federal penal facility. And there is someone in his family who's very sick, very, very ill. And word comes that, you know, this person may have only hours or days, and they will at various times arrange a deathbed visit for that inmate. There are also times, as you look at our penal system, where a man may be sentenced for a very long prison term. But our law allows that man some freedom. They will provide for him what is commonly called a work furlough. I'm persuaded that as a lot of people look at 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, and I'm talking about Christians, we look at the binding or we look at the chaining of Satan in a way that is far too literal. Yes, he was cast down. The Bible's clear on that point. Peter says that, we believe that. Yes, Satan and the other angels have been bound. God says that, and we believe that. We have no doubt about that. But the removal from heaven and the chaining do not mean that the devil has been completely incapacitated. Notice, if you will, from 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, that Peter says he's chained, but he doesn't tell us how long those chains are. I think there's some people sometimes who look at that text and they think the chains are like that. Well, again, if we look at dogs, dogs can have a very lengthy chain. They can sometimes get further than they need to be or further than they should be. So we're not specifically told the limits of his chains or boundaries. Certainly when we look at the first century, we find that Satan and his helpers were given some unique opportunities. We also find passages like this, Colossians 2, verse 15. There in the midst of that Colossian letter, about halfway through it, Paul said, Jesus has despoiled the principalities and the powers. Well, he's not talking about good heavenly creatures. He's talking about evil heavenly creatures. He was bringing them down. Paul goes on to say he made an open show of them. As you look at Satan, we find that we have at least two statements in the Bible about him being defeated twice. There was the defeat by God in his initial rebellion at the beginning of time. Satan rebelled, he lost. God is still in heaven, Satan is not there, he was cast down. Then we find a second defeat by Satan about 2,000 years ago. As you look at Satan, you find that a time is coming when there will be a third defeat of the devil. When Jesus comes back, that will be Satan's third strike. In baseball, it's three strikes and you're out. When I look at the Bible, I find at least three strikes, three major strikes in the existence of Satan. He lost in the beginning. He lost 2,000 years ago. And the Bible predicts that he will also lose at the beginning of time. He and his forces are chained. They're greatly restrained. But he's still working as hard as he possibly can. Satan's final defeat is guaranteed to such a degree that Paul comments on it in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 3. This is a passage that people ask about at various times. Paul, as he gets into the subject of lawsuits, makes a reference to Christians judging angels. And one of the questions that pops up from time to time is, well, when are we going to do that? Or how is that going to work? Well, there are a lot of things that we simply do not know about this particular chapter. Paul does not say if the church is going to judge good angels or bad angels or both. My explanation of the passage is twofold. First of all, angels, would you not agree, have already been judged? They have. We have good angels. They've made the right choice. God has kept them in heaven. We have evil angels. They have made their choice as well, and they've been judged. They've been cast down. We've noted from 2 Peter 2:4 as well as Jude 6 that there were some angels that chose sin, and there were consequences for that action. I can find, as I look at the Bible, no basis for a future judgment of angels as we normally think of the word judgment. But what I do find is this. I find information about a sentence being pronounced. Think back to perhaps one of the well-known passages, one of the most well-known passages in the life of Jesus, Matthew 25. It is a picture, it is a scene of the final judgment. It's where Jesus says, come you blessed of my Father and inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry and I had all these needs and you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. Then as he gets down to Matthew 25, verse 41, he will say to the unsaved, depart from me. He will say to this other group on his left, depart into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. You see, the judgment will have already been made by the time we get to that point. When we die, Hebrews 9:27 says, and inasmuch as it is appointed unto man once to die, and then cometh the judgment. So when we talk about the judgment day at the end of time, that's really a misnomer. The judgment will have already been passed as far as whether we are a righteous man or not righteous. We see that principle in Luke chapter 16. We're not the men judged. Well, if you're going to be on the good side of Hades, a judgment has to be rendered. If you're going to be like the wicked man, the evil man, and on the unsafe side of the Hadean realm, again, there has to be a judgment. So the judgment has been made. What has not been made is the passing of an eternal sentence. Based on that, as I look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, it seems to me that when Paul talks about men judging angels, he's not saying that we're going to go ahead and look at an angel's existence and we're going to go through the angels one by one and say, okay, here's what you did, here's perhaps what you didn't do, and we give our vote for salvation or condemnation. Rather, as we look at the principles that I've laid out, it seems to me, this is my judgment on the matter, and that's all it is a judgment. That instead of the word judgment conveying its normal meaning, Paul has in mind the idea of a sentence. He has in mind not that we're going to be passing the sentence, but when that sentence is passed by God, Matthew 25, verse 41, whether it is a sentence that is passed on men or whether it is a sentence that is given to the angels, we on the day of judgment, all people, but especially Christians, will look at every single sentence that is handed down by God and say, this is exactly right. If a person is said to be on the side of the right, come, you blessed of my Father, and inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world, we will give our approval to that particular sentence because we will understand at that particular point in time God's perspective, God's holiness, God's ability to judge justly. When those good angels are allowed to continue to spend eternity with God, we will understand, we will endorse that decision, if you will. We will also at that time understand why evil angels are worthy not only of punishment, but worthy of eternal punishment, separation from God forever and ever. In life, that may be hard to understand right now. A person may say, I just can't comprehend why that would be the right thing to do. But if I understand 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul said, when we get to that day and time, we will have a full comprehension of that point. As evil as Satan and his helpers are, God will treat them fairly, and we will have a full comprehension of that. Well, Satan knows that that final sentence is coming. Judgment has already been passed on him. He knows what that judgment is. But he's not yet been sentenced to that place of eternal punishment. So he walks, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, to and fro. His chains are long enough to go ahead and try to affect and influence and take each one of us. That's his goal. God, on the other hand, also wants us. Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9, that God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Two forces in our world, Satan and his forces, God and his forces, and we're the deciding factor. We decide if we're going to line up with Satan and his crew, or we're going to choose the side of God and righteousness. And folks, that's the most important choice we will ever make. A lot of the choices that we make in life, we may be wrong about. We may think, I need to go right or left. We go right and we should have gone left. Or I should have bought this or I should have bought that. And it turns out we should have bought neither. But here's a choice we do not want to be wrong about because it has eternal consequences. Tonight, if you're not in the right relationship with God, will you not consider that as we sing the invitation song? If you've not yet become a Christian, the steps are so simple, so easy. Faith, repentance, confession, and baptism, they can be done very, very quickly. How sad it will be for people to spend eternity having had a chance to hear the gospel but not obeyed it and to think about all the times that they had to become a Christian, but for whatever reason, they never obeyed the gospel. If the Bible is right, those angels in the Hadean realm, chained in pits of darkness, that's not the faith that I want for my life, and I believe it's not the faith that you want for your life. If something needs to be done to right your relationship with God, tonight, we have the courage to do it as we stand and sing the selected song.